For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Tonight we're going to talk about the second chapter on Judaism, and I was, for those who are new tonight, I mentioned this last week, that many of you know the author of the book, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. He was the Rav in Atlanta for 39 years and retired 24 years ago from that job. He's hardly retired. He still is ministering to dozens and dozens of Atlanta families that live in Israel and worldwide through his writing and the like. What some of you may not know is that the author is my wife's grandfather. And so I read the book before I met him, but it's a great pleasure. I should have sent him the email this morning about the second class. When I sent him the email last week about the first class, he was very complimentary, saying he wanted to come to the class. I'm not sure what he really means by that. He once told me a funny story. I probably shouldn't say this, and certainly not recorded, but it's a hilarious story. He was telling me that in Yerushalayim, you can't get away with anything. Like everyone is smarter than the next person. That's Israelis. So he published a new book. I think, I don't know which book it was, because he has many books, but it might have been the book called Tales Out of Jerusalem. I think it might have been that. And he was in a bookseller in Yerushalayim when he said, "Do you carry the book Tales Out of Jerusalem?" So the seller says, "Yes." He says, "How's it selling?" So the seller says, "You're the author." He says, "What do you mean?" The author says, "No one would ask how's it selling unless you're the author." Right. So that's, you like, in Arizona, if you say how's it selling, they're like, "Oh, great." Sure. You know? Yeah. So, anyway, this is, as I was reading this chapter again, it occurred to me that this is, The issue of God is obviously one that is on the minds of people all the time, because it's so hard to comprehend and so hard to, certainly so hard to articulate. And so it's just fascinating the precision with which he covers the topic in about 30 pages. And I just have a feeling that 100 years from now, people will be reading this chapter, because it's so, in such a casual way, he goes to the heart of matters that are very, very esoteric and consequential. That's really, really what it is. The topic is so consequential. It's the heart of the whole deal. In other words, in the Seder, it says that the Rasha, the evil son, asks a question that implies that he's not interested in keeping the mitzvahs himself. You know, what does this work for you? Right? So The author of the Haggadah says, because he says for you and takes himself out of the observance, it's like he is kafar ba'ikar, is the Hebrew language, that he disputes the fundamental point. This is the fundamental point. When we say being kafar ba'ikar, that he disputes the fundamental point. The fundamental point is that Jews believe in God. There is no more fundamental point of Yiddishkeit than Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. That's our national anthem, never to be replaced. That's what it means to be Jewish, is to believe that Hashem exists. And I wrote down just a few words. Hashem exists, Hashem creates, Hashem is infinite, Hashem is Echad, which we'll go into a little bit more. Hashem doesn't have a physical form. I once heard, actually at the very opening first ever event of what became this shul, which just going back, way back when, I was the director of the Kola, we started a learning center in this neighborhood in conjunction with Eshet Torah International. And it was called the Eshet Torah Scottsdale Center for Jewish Discovery. And at the very first event ever at the Eshet Torah Scottsdale Center for Jewish Discovery, the speaker was Rabbi Ari Khan from Eshet Torah in Jerusalem.
I was I was there too.
It was a real decrepit situation. We hadn't built it out yet or anything like that.
Pizza.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
We were in this little room.
Yeah. That little room became the shul. Right? It would look nicer a little while later.
Rabbi Kahn's son?
Yeah, that's Rabbi Kahn's son. Yeah, Pinky's
son. Yeah, I know from New York.
Yeah.
Very first event ever, either December 02 or January 03. Very first event ever. He said, he asked the question, how can you describe God? And he said, the very best sentence about God is, God is. After that, whatever word you'll say will limit in a way. And that made a very big impression on me. Yet we are forced to come up with language to describe something infinite. And of course, the finite, which is your and my mind, all of our words, will have trouble dealing with the infinite. One of the children in the shul asked me this week, who created Hashem? Hashem created everything. Who created Hashem? So I said to her, you probably know who it is. It's a little girl that you're related to. Okay. She said to me, who created Hashem? So I said, if you say that something is created, then that means that before it was created, it didn't exist. Right? She said, yeah. I said, so since it can't be that Hashem didn't ever exist, we can see that Hashem can't be created, right? So she said, right. And was settled until an older kid, who should have let the younger kid feel happy with the answer, yeah, but wait a second, and then it was all chaos right there. So it is hard to give our language to it, and therefore, right from the beginning, he addresses something that I'm sure is not a bother to anybody here, that why does the Torah express Hashem in anthropomorphic forms? The outstretched hand, the back of God, the front of God, the eyes, right? These things. So it's because we need language to express notions that we can relate to. And so we express them in certain ways. It doesn't mean that God has a hand. It means that the way someone does things with a hand is how we're describing what Hashem is doing in being creative, in being powerful, in being whatever it may be. But no words can ever be the beginning and the end and a good description of something that is infinite and far beyond any description. And although I don't think Rabbi Feldman mentions this any place in the book, I think what comes to my mind is a very important idea that's expressed in the Medrash Rabbah in Shemos. In Parashas Shemos, Moshe is having his first. In the book of Shemos, Exodus, there are several moments, primarily a little later, where we get into a real esoteric language between Moshe and Hashem, right? The only comparable moment in Torah probably is when Avraham and Hashem have a dialogue in the time of Sodom, but otherwise, later on here we have Moshe is told by Hashem at the burning bush, go back there and tell them that I'm going to redeem them. And he says, what's your name? Right, so that's what he says, what's your name? And Hashem responds, Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I will be as I will be. And based on the Gemara, there are some who won't pronounce it that way. Just like they don't say Elohim, they say Elohim. So they say Ekyeh asher ehyeh, because God is expressing a name of his. So the Medrash in Shemos Rabbah says that people can be described by names, because the beginning and the end of that person, their totality, is expressed in their name, right? So I'm looking across the table at Peretz Shalom. I'm looking next to me at the table at Yaakov. I'm looking at Avram Yidl ben Yosef HaKohen, right? That's your whole thing. I'm sure you haven't figured out exactly how that's your whole thing, right? That's your whole thing. Therefore, by the Ribono Shalom, it's impossible that there could be one name. One name that summarizes it all can't be. So the Medrash says, that Hashem responds to him, I will be as I will be. When I am sitting in judgment, I'm Elohim. When I am standing on the throne of mercy, I'm Hashem, Yud Hei Vav Hei. When I am waging war against the enemies, I'm Hashem Tzvakot, God of, Master of Legions. You know, and so on and so forth. Ribono Shel Olam can't be names are so defining. So isn't it obvious that it's beyond the possibility that Hashem could be described in a single name? So Rabbi Feldman deals with this anthropomorphic notion on 34, and he also, on page 34, there's a long paragraph here that I want to explore together about the concept of being echad, of being one. So the rabbi character here says, on page 34, but it's not necessary, by the way, I believe that it's not necessary to read the book to benefit from this conversation, and certainly not necessary to have the book in front of you, but I do believe that the book says it better than I could say it at all. Right, and so we will refer back and forth to the book sometimes, but not necessarily all the time. So he says like this, true enough, the Torah speaks in the language of people, but finite language is inadequate to articulate infinite concepts, like the might or awe or love or providence or wrath or compassion of God. So the Torah utilizes terms like God's right hand or eyes of God, even though such expressions might mislead the ignorant. But let us not digress. God is one, separate and apart from the world he created, and yet he is also part of his world, concerned with it and its inhabitants. He is unique and distinct from everything else, but he is also within the world he created. He did not set the clock of the universe in motion and then retire. He remains active, though hidden, and he listens and guides. He taps us on the spiritual shoulder from time to time to let us know that he is there. In the language of philosophy, this intimate aspect of God is called immanence, while the distant aspect is called transcendence. In the words of the daily Amida, he is El HaGadol HaGibor VaHanora, the great, mighty, awesome, supreme being, who performs loving kindness, remembers the kindness of the patriarchs, and brings a redeemer to their children's children for his name's sake in love. That is to say, he is above us and is all-powerful, but at the same time he listens to us and he cares. That word Echad, one, has far-reaching resonance beyond its literal meaning. For example, it means that there is unity in the entire universe, that all of creation is a demonstration of God's constant presence. It means that we ourselves are not separate from God, but that we too are, or at least can potentially be, at one with God and not separate from him. Now, you know, we could talk about this forever. All right, we can't do this in one class, and we can't do it in one section of one class. And that's why, as I was reading this, I was thinking, it has to be read and reread and reread and recontemplated. But the concept of Echad, should be dealt with to some degree with something that he mentions much later in the chapter about the name of God being called Hamakom. God is sometimes referred to as Hamakom. Hamakom means the place. Very odd name for God. But if you think about it, is Hashem in the universe? Or is the universe in Hashem?
Hashem's in the universe.
Hashem is in the universe. That means, by implication, in theory, not that I disagree with you, you should just know.
Hashem is here, that's what I mean.
I know that's what you mean. But if Hashem is in the universe and not the universe is in Hashem,
universe.
Then he begins here and ends there, and beyond him is the universe that encompasses him. If Hashem is in the universe, like I'm in this room, then there's me from the end of this shoulder to the end of this shoulder, and there's the room that I am within, so I am limited to this space, and then I'm in the room, and the room is larger, which is impossible about Hashem. Because Hashem cannot be limited to being with us in this place as opposed to that one. So when we say Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, like Uncle Moshe said, right? So it's true and it's important, and children should be taught this. And when you start dealing with it as a grown-up, right, it's beyond our ability to express the real truth of the matter. Therefore, Hashem is called Hamakom, because he is the place within which all other things, including the entire universe, exist, because logically he must be. If we're defining God as infinite and limitless, then he must be larger than large can be, and anything that exists must exist within him
since he is boundless. So he's called Hamakom. He's boundless. That's what Echad means. Echad means that there is nothing in the world that's an expression of something other than Hashem. Okay, that brings up all kinds of philosophical questions. You mean this, that, and the other thing is also Hashem? Okay, I'm not getting into that yet. We may touch on that a little bit later, maybe. But that is what the logical conclusion must be if you're describing a limitless, truly monotheistic, echad being. Go ahead, please.
The word Elohim ends in Yud and Mem Sofit.
Yes.
Which expresses plurality. How do we bring that into the God?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. And God is also expressed sometimes as male, usually as male, and sometimes as female. Right? Like the word Shekhinah is a feminine form, but all the verb forms in the Chumash are male or masculine. Right? So the best I can say about that is that God is beyond any of these things, and there is sometimes expression of things, like I said before about names, there's expression of elements. So for example, the male-female thing is a little easier to deal with in the sense that in the purely reproductive sense, the male is the contributor and the female form is the receiver in a purely biological sense of the matter. And so wherever God is described as creative, it makes sense that the creation is in a masculine form. However, in the reproductive sense, a man is filled with a million ideas, 10 million ideas, none of them that are going to actually come true at all, because he's just a crazy man. Okay? Until he gets grounded by the receiver, nourisher, and cultivator of only one of those million ideas. Fascinating reality. Unbelievable reality that's expressed in human behavior. It's expressed in human behavior forever, even as the world wants to tell you that there's no differences between anybody. Right? That's fiction. Right? There are basic differences between essences. And so the feminine form in that sense is the form of having come into being. That's Shekhinah. Shekhinah, which relates to this worldly matters, is a reality of being, not a reality of actively creating. The Shekhinah doesn't create. The Shekhinah is present. Right? It's real. It's realized. It's realized. And that's expressed in the feminine. So the best I can say about your question, which I really maybe is best expressed in a three-word phrase, which is, I don't know, right? But the best I can say about your very valid question is that that sometimes there is singularity that we recognize, and sometimes there's duality or multiplicity, and that we have trouble realizing the singularity of it. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam is expressed in mostly in singular, sometimes in plural, as you pointed out, and mostly in masculine, sometimes in feminine, because he's beyond any of these descriptions. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. It's the best I can do. That's a tough question and a very good one. Okay, so I wanted to point your attention to page 35. There's a lot of big things here, and on 38 we're going to get to the word implications, which I think is a very special word the way he uses it. But let's go to this notion of implications quickly, and then we'll visit it more deeply a little bit later. The question of whether Hashem exists, there can be no more significant question than that. I mean, let me say like this. It's a two-part question, really. The question is, does Hashem exist? And did this Hashem tell us how to behave? And if the answer is yes, and yes, then the implications are very dramatic. Very dramatic, because not only because you have to, or you're supposed to, follow the rules, but also because it's foolish not to follow the rules, because it's like buying a state-of-the-art television set that can do a million things. And when I mean state-of-the-art, I mean, I don't even know, but the TVs today can do, like, you know, it's not a TV. It's a million things inside that box. It's an internet server. It's a this, it's a that, whatever. And you say, I don't really care how to get the most out of it. I just like it for this limited thing. I don't care how to get the most out of it. That's foolish. So, yeah. But if you can't figure out how to turn it on, then you go to the owner's manual, right? And you say, what does the owner's manual say about how to effectively watch these two shows at the same time? Or go from last watch channel back to the other one as I'm flipping between things so I don't have to count up from 2 to 690, you know, or whatever it is. So you go to the owner's manual, and it's foolish not to ever deal with the owner's manual. So there's major implications. So on 35, he writes like this. David says, that's all very pretty, but what do you do with someone who has no appreciation for these things, who is not even sure whether or not he believes in God in the first place? And the rabbi says, for a contemporary Jew seeking a way back to God, I think that the best antidote is to begin to perform some of the mitzvot. Belief in God is not necessarily the beginning. It can also be the end result. In your situation, perhaps you should behave in God, and then belief in God will inevitably follow. By behaving in God, I mean to try to live in a certain Jewish way, to act in a certain Jewish way, which is the way of the mitzvah. The sages relate a remarkable oral tradition about God's reaction to the sin of the golden calf. When God sees that his people are engaged in idolatry, he cries out, although they have abandoned me, let them at least observe the mitzvot of my Torah. Okay, so they don't believe in me. This, what the rabbi is saying here, is expressed many, many, many times in a book called Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch was a work written in the generation after the Rambam, where he took the Rambam's identifying of the 613 mitzvos. Okay, take a step back. The sages tell us that there are 613 mitzvos, but they don't tell us which they are. They don't tell us which statements in the Chumash are the 613 mitzvos. They tell us about some. That's a mitzvah, it's a prohibition, whatever it may be. So commentators around the beginning of the, around the 10th and 11th and 12th centuries comment on what are the 630 mitzvos. So the Sefer HaChinuch takes the Rambam's count based on laws that the Rambam creates and expands the discussion of each one of the mitzvos into many details. He says time and time and time again that Hashem tells us to behave in certain ways so that we begin to feel certain ways, so that we begin to think certain ways. In the language of the Chinuch, in his succinct language where he says it in the very beginning of the book, he says, Adam nif'al achar pe'ulotav. A person is becomes based on how he behaves. So we know this. Like, let's say you want to become nicer. So you're not nice. Do nice things. If you do nice things, you'll become nice. You'll learn to care about other people. You'll see the value in caring for other people, etc. To the outsider in the performance of mitzvos, many things, or contemplations of all these kinds, to the outsider, sometimes things that to every one of us make a lot of sense, to the outsider they seem ridiculous. It's impossible. There will never be justification about why I can't sit with my wife in shul. Never be. There will never be a justification for such a thing. Right? That's what somebody would say from the outside. And then from the inside, somebody might say, I can be Jewish with my wife. Nobody told me I can't be Jewish with my wife. Judaism exists in it's in every part of my life. We're Jewish together all the time. Oh, but I do pray better when I'm not worried about whether my wife thinks I'm behaving nicely.
And I pray better when I'm not worried about how I look to my beloved. And so on and so forth. It's distracting. I didn't come here to discuss mechitza tonight, but it's just one example of the idea that there's a long distance to travel between the one who says, it can never be explained to me. It's insane. To the one who says, I would never do without it. And we all know many people, perhaps for some of us, it's the person in the mirror, maybe. We all know who travel that distance. Right? So it's just by one very simple example, and I have a million others, that if you take the leap, is what the rabbi is saying, and I'm going to talk about this more, because he's not saying take a leap when it's nonsense. Maybe you believe that God has credibility for various reasons. There is a God. I don't really get it. I can't really explain it. I'm not sure that he spoke at Sinai, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the Jewish philosophical truths is try it. Try the behaviors, the commitment to the behaviors, and inner thinking sometimes comes after. That's very foreign to Western philosophy in our generation. In our generation, it's sort of like, I'm not feeling it. So since I'm not feeling it, I'm not doing it. Right? And the truth is that, particularly for men can spend a whole lifetime never feeling it. So then if the whole thing is, I'll do it once I feel it, when in the world is this guy going to get around to it? Right? Exactly, when he feels like it, right? So the Torah says there are disciplines, and if you follow and commit to the disciplines, the feeling of it, the understanding of it will follow. By the way, this is as fundamental as the two words we all know, Na'aseh v'Nishma, that sages said, the Jewish people said at Har Sinai. They said, we will do, and then we will hear. They said that, and I said this recently in a drasha here in Shul, they said that when they didn't know what it was going to be. We say that when we know what the rule is, it's just not resonating yet. So, okay, not resonating yet. But if you behave in God, it's amazing what kind of things come into your understanding. Because people understand things very, very differently. On page 32nd, I want you to know, just like last week, I'm skipping from my in the notes. To get through my notes would take weeks at a time. There's so much to be said, and I want to recommend reading and rereading. But on page 37, doesn't look like it's 37. Yeah, the very top. The rabbi says like this, nothing important happens effortlessly, but when you live a religious life, positive things begin to develop inside you without your being aware of it. That's because there is an inner logic to belief in God. Objectively speaking, it's not just a matter of blind faith, and that's why it can begin to develop within you when you at least open yourself to the concept. Because when you look at it objectively, belief in God is not at all illogical. To insist that the world and all its magnificent and complex parts are simply a result of chance creates more intellectual and logical problems, it seems to me, than does belief in God. The entire natural universe testifies that there is a God, as King David expresses it in Psalm 19, Hashamayim Misaprim Kvod Kael, the heavens declare the glory of God. So here we touch on the question of how do you know? And that's a tough question for a lot of people. It's in my experience, time and time and time again, different things speak to different people. I often think that if I had been alive in the generation of Avraham, I would not have been one of his followers. Because, first of all, it takes unbelievable courage to turn away from what everybody else believes and follow this one. He'll forgive me for saying this, but I guarantee this is what they said about him. This one nut. Okay? It takes a lot of courage to do that.
But also the Rambam tells us in the beginning of the laws of Avodah Zarah, in the first chapter, the Rambam tells us that Avraham believed that just as everything has a creator, this too, the world too must have a creator. And this is what he was telling people. So only recently, and I mean very recently, has that logical argument been compelling to me at all. Now, if it's compelling to you, I don't want to knock you off that horse. That's good. There are other reasons why I have absolute clarity that the master of the universe exists. No doubt about it at all. But what I'm really trying to express is that what will inspire my clarity may not inspire you at all. And what inspires your clarity may not inspire me at all. And that's why it really doesn't get anywhere for people to argue with other people based on their own stuff and say, I don't understand how you cannot believe it. After all, da 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 da. If it was so simple, it would be so simple. It's not so simple, even though I agree with the rabbi's position here, that it's entirely illogical to believe that your eye is a matter of accident. That is entirely illogical. That makes no sense at all. It makes no, it's nonsense that random occurrences created this magnificence called the world and its inner workings. That's much less logical than the belief that there's an organized design of the whole thing. Random made the interrelationship between photosynthesis and the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom, and it's nonsense, honestly. Now, having said that, a lot of people believe that. Why do they believe that? Well, the main reason they believe it, and I said I will get to this, I'm not going to get to it now, is because of the implications. There's tremendous desire to not believe in God, because if you don't believe in God, you can do whatever you want. And most people want to do whatever they want. That's really a basic human instinct, to not be told by other people what to do. It's called autonomy. It's arguably the main god of the society in which we live. It's personal autonomy. Don't tell me that anything is defined by some outside source. If my mind wants to define it this way, then it's up to me. And then the other people say, and that's true. And you're courageous. You should, if you want to call afternoon morning, you call afternoon morning. No problem. So people want to do whatever they want. So the stakes are very high when you talk about the Ribbono Shel Olam. If Hashem exists, the stakes are very high. Now I want to tell you what does move me personally. And having said that, it may not move you. I love this paragraph that the rabbi character, Rabbi Feldman, speaks to, because this moves me, although it didn't always move me when I was growing up or even as an adult, but it moves me now. But there are other things that move me very deeply. One of them is expressed on page 39. On page 39, where the paragraph says God and the Jews in the far right margin, the rabbi is just responding to David, who says, I didn't think our conversation had such cosmic significance. Perhaps we should be standing in honor of the occasion rather than just sitting comfortably. The rabbi says, perhaps so. After all, every aspect of Torah study and Torah discussion has cosmic significance. What I mean is this. You and I have no rational reason for being alive as Jews after what our people has been through in the years since Sinai. And yet here we are. The very fact that the Jewish people continues to exist despite everything says something about the mysterious relationship between this people and a transcendent force which somehow wishes us to remain alive and which maintains our existence. By transcendent force, of course, I mean God. Those familiar biblical promises about the Jews being an eternal people, about our suffering and tragedies, but also about God never abandoning us, these take on tremendous meaning and power almost 4,000 years after they were first uttered to Abraham. And with every passing generation, they take on added power. I want to interrupt and tell you like this. Even the biggest heretic knows that the Torah was written over 2,000 years ago.
That can't be, that's the most liberal position, is that the book exists for thousands of years, regardless of who you hold wrote it. You can't, there's no doubt that it exists since it was translated into Greek a couple thousand years ago. So that's not debatable. So even if you want to say, well, who says it was written 4,000 years ago and he said to Abraham? Granted, it was only written 2,000 years ago. Fine, for the moment, even though that's not true. But for the moment, you can have that. Okay, now back to the ranch. Remember, it was only a promise given to Abraham, yet Abraham and his children and children's children staked their very lives on that promise. 2,000 years after Abraham, as the Jews went into exile from their promised land, it may have seemed absurd. Imagine yourself as a Jew seeing Jerusalem destroyed by the Babylonians. You would surely say, yes, we have been kept alive since the times of Abraham. Yes, we had kings like David and Solomon and prophets like Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah. But all that is over now. Our land is destroyed. Our holy place is pillaged. Our people massacred. And here we are marching into slavery and chains. It's all over. We are history. The end. And yet here we are today, 2,000 years after the slave marches, 37 centuries after Abraham, and only 50 years after a third of our people were slaughtered in this 20th century. And we are alive, vital, dynamic, and flourishing. There is something very strange and mysterious about the Jewish people. Now, all this may not necessarily prove that God exists. It may all be a fluke of history. It may all have happened by chance. It could all be attributed to random occurrences. But isn't it curious that no other people has benefited from such randomness and that no other people has lived through such a history? Look, for example, at Leviticus 26:44. After the long list of terrible prophecies which will befall Israel if they abandon God, the Torah states unequivocally that God will never destroy us and that he will always maintain his covenant with us. The fact is, the biblical promise is still very much alive today, and if the Bible is still alive, then is it not logical that the author of that Bible is still alive as well? This, for me, is the whole story, personally. Just know, I wake up in the morning, and the fact that Klal Yisrael exists, in spite of the fact that it violates all the rules of existence, and there is nobody else, and all the details of how we exist are delineated in the Torah itself, thousands of years ago, I don't care how many thousand you want, okay? Thousands of years ago, somebody wrote that you're going to be dispersed, hated, few in number, oppressed, and you will return to your land and you'll exist forever. Somebody wrote that thousands of years ago. That, to me personally, is an undeniable evidence that the master of the universe exists. You all know, I'm certain, the quote from Mark Twain in Harper's Magazine in 1899, where he said that all the great societies of yesteryear rose and filled the world with splendor, the Romans, the Greeks, etc. But where are they now? The Jew has seen them all, defeated them all, and is every bit as great as he always was. What is the secret to his immortality? And the and so that reality, there was something else I wanted to tell you. Oh, yes. And it's really worth reading about this. There was a great historian, if any of you have been to a discovery seminar, then you've heard this also. But there was a great historian in the middle of the 20th century in England. His name was Arnold Toynbee. You know, he's widely considered like the greatest historian of that era. And Toynbee wrote about, I think, 26 civilizations in 14 volumes and posited rules of what makes civilizations rise and then fall. And what makes them rise, the Jews have hardly ever had. What makes them fall, the Jews have been the worst victims of. And so we shouldn't exist. And the great lover of the Jewish people, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, who passed away a few years ago, I heard him speak in Washington, D.C. at an event about Gudas Yisrael. And I hope I never forget what he said. His opening words, this little short senator who only had one arm, he gave up one arm in the war, okay, amazing person. So Senator Inouye gets up and he says, where are the Babylonians? Where are the Medes? But you are here. That's how he opened his speech to a Jewish group. Fantastic. But the answer is, that can't happen. And certainly not with the details of being spelled out before. Like as if God wrote a book 2,000 years ago, somebody wrote a book 2,000 years ago, which is, Toynbee's going to come up with philosophies and we're going to violate every single one of them. Here it is.
You know? Yeah, but Toynbee said the Jews were an accident of history.
Right. And he also said that the current Jews must only be a vestigial remnant of the ancient Jews soon to be wiped out. OK,
because the rules have to apply. So if the rules always have to apply, but they don't apply in one case, then there's something special about that one case. Could it be an accident? Sure, one thing could be an accident compared to every single other thing in the world. But which is more logical? Right? So for me, that's very moving. For another one, everything I just said might be, it's not resonating. You know, for me, that's very, very moving. And for others, there's many other things. You know, when you see symmetry in Torah, when you see symmetry you hear, and this is a little bit of a higher level a little bit, but sometimes you'll hear perhaps a Kabbalistic Torah, and in that sense, I don't mean pop Kabbalah, you know, but you'll hear something where you say that much symmetry in the point, including how the letter forms are made or whatever, it just can't be by accident. Who wrote that? It can't be by accident. So these things are history and the Torah itself are major influences on my personal sense of Hashem has to exist. But now we come to probably the most important part, which is on page 38. We're going back a little bit, where the rabbi says, David says, with all that evidence around, how is it that there are so many unbelievers in the world? I thought the term was non-believers, by the way. I don't believe that there are so many unbelievers. What we do have are many people who simply don't think things through. Right? So before we go on, that's very true about in general. Right? The first thing that happens when we get in the car is the radio goes on. The first thing that we do when we get home is that some other media goes on so that we don't have to think about it. Whatever it is.
When you plug in your cell phone.
Yeah. Perfect. You know, whatever it is, you don't have to think about it. Right? We invite noise into our lives. So most people have not really thought it through. That's a very important idea also, just when you think about the impact you can have on other people, not in an overbearing kind of a way, but so, and particularly on children or your grandchildren, whatever it is. People want to think things through, a lot of people. They don't mean to be unengaged about it. They're just not engaged about it. So there are people who are open to things to a measure. So the rabbi tells me this. The rabbi says most people simply don't think things through. David says, or maybe they're afraid to think things through. Maybe they're afraid of the implications. This is the word I was talking about. The rabbi says, quite true, because the implications that there is a God and that this God tells me how to live and what I may and may not do, this can seriously cramp a person's style. So, yeah, and I want to tell you something. I think that's true about all of us. I don't think that that's a binary statement. That's not true about, well, people who aren't religious, but we religious people, blah, blah, blah. No, no, no. That's true about everybody in this room. There's everybody in every room wants to not really think too much about it, because if you think too much about it, there's something that we're hanging on to that we think we ought not be hanging on to. And there's something that we're being lazy about that we realize, maybe I shouldn't be lazy about that. And so the implications thing makes every one of us turn on the radio or play with our cell phone or whatever the application might be. It makes us all go, I don't want to think about that. But it's kind of painful to think about the simplistic world of the person who says, I believe in God, as if it's some minor matter. Like, not minor, totally insignificant matter. You know, I mentioned, I think it was last week here at this table, it's fascinating that society still, in a society where religion makes almost no impact in society, almost every funeral in America is a religious ceremony. It's a fascinating thing. Fascinating thing. Because that's a time when people don't have a problem with implications. What do I care? I'm going on anyway. Right? I don't have to behave differently. And the other side of that, of course, that we mentioned last week is a disaster, which is that if you don't believe in any religious framework at all at that moment in life, then you might as well not even have the ceremony because it's all over anyway. So who cares? Right? It's just like who cares? So it's a fascinating, fascinating thing. So this implications thing,
is the only piece, is the only word on my in my notes that's in all caps and underlined. Implications. And the truth is that if I could give a little bit of mussar to everybody, myself included, imagine how your life would be would be enriched, really, if you asked yourself for 5 minutes a day to spend 5 minutes alone saying, what are the implications of the fact that I am one of the people who is on this earth who believes that Hashem created the world, created me, all who came before me and all who come after me, that I'm going to meet him again, and gave a rule book about how I'm supposed to behave. Okay, you don't want to do that because it's too difficult, it's too intimidating. Right? But the point is, otherwise it's kind of a silly enterprise, because that's the whole point. The whole point is, what am I supposed to do with it? What am I supposed to do? Okay, enough about that. When you think of me tomorrow and you say, I'm not spending that 5 minutes, he can have his own 5 minutes, he'll be thinking about that. Okay, man, I have so much more to say, but it's late-ish, not very late yet. But maybe I'll ask: are there any questions? Because I've been doing almost all the talking tonight.
He brings up the fact that not only do you have to believe in God, but you have to trust God. That was one of his big points, that God is responsible for everything. You got to feel that whatever happens is for the best because you can trust in God. But my question is really this: you know, if Hashem is responsible for everything, but we have free will, when does free will come in, and when does Hashem responsible for everything?
Are your points related? Because I'm not hearing the connection between the question and the first point. Can you maybe repeat it, or
That the rabbi here points out that not only do you have to believe in God, but you have to trust in God.
Okay.
So I said that trust comes in when someone says that God is responsible for everything that happens, and that everything that happens is for the best. So you have to trust that, you know, in God, that he's doing the right thing for you and your family, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think I get it now. Okay, so, and you're asking, where does your decision come into play versus if Hashem brings about all the results,
right?
Then, and that's causing the trust. How do we sort of have
free will?
Well, but I think you're not asking the free will question. You're asking the self-determination question. How much do we determine versus how much does Hashem determine?
Well, when you say how much do you determine, isn't that free will? You have a right to do certain things. Because you have free will. That's a concept within free will.
Okay, okay. Yeah, okay. Yes, you know, definitely.
I always ask the rabbi, you know, if someone sins, why doesn't God strike him down? And the answer was, if he did, there wouldn't be free will. And if everyone knew that God was going to take, you know, action against them, then they wouldn't do anything bad, then that does away with free will. That was his explanation.
Right, so I guess what's troubling me in your question is I think you're touching on a lot of different big things, and that's why I said from the very beginning, I'm amazed by how in a concise chapter he touches on so many things. So I'm going to do my best to address some of the things you said. The Gemara says in Masechta Brachos, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyiras shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven.
Except what?
The fear of heaven. Okay? It's axiomatic to our faith system that you have the free will to choose between right and wrong. Whether or not your free will decision to choose between right and wrong plays out into good or bad or success or failure is Hashem's realm. The fact that it usually does is what makes it free will. In other words, usually, if the trigger is pulled, then the object is hit. But sometimes when the trigger is pulled, the trigger gets stuck. And then, in all law systems of the world, the person who's then stopped before he can get the trigger unstuck has committed attempted murder, but not murder itself, right? I don't know the answer to the question I'm about to pose, but I think I know the answer. I think in the heavenly court there's no difference. I don't know if there's a difference in the heavenly court, but I think there's no difference. In other words, just because you're a bad shot in the earthly court, they excuse you for that, right? But in the heavenly court, you made the whole decision to do this terrible, egregious act, and you got lucky that you're a bad shot, or your gun didn't work. But you didn't really get lucky. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who runs the whole picture, in his orchestration of the whole picture, stopped that attempted bad from happening, and it didn't happen. And when he doesn't stop the attempted bad from happening, so as hard as this is for us to deal with sometimes in the particular, narrow particular case that anybody has experienced, as hard as that is to deal with, the master universe has allowed it to happen. And so it's part of the divine will, if you will, of how the world is supposed to run. So free will is your decision to choose between right and wrong. Success and failure is up to Hashem. Just as free will is your decision whether to place the ad, you know how many people have called their plumbing service AAA plumbing, thinking they're going to make more money? They're going to make more money because AAA plumbing will be first in the yellow pages. I can't imagine anybody does that now, right? We got the yellow pages 2 days ago. So did the recycling bin on the same day. So, you know, I doubt anybody does that today. But AAA plumbing, the guy who writes AAA plumbing, he's a chacham, and he says, I'm going to make more money now. And the rabbi writes this someplace so beautifully. In fact, I think it's in that point where you said about belief and trust. Look, this is it. Top of 42. One leads to the other. Belief must come first because obviously you cannot trust in something you do not believe exists. Listen to this sentence though. But it is possible to believe in the theoretical existence of God and still rage at adversity and behave as if your fate depended on your own efforts or on chance or on the good or bad will of associates and competitors. Trust, on the other hand, is very personal. When you trust in God, you have the confidence and serenity to accept whatever befalls you as God's will. So you see, belief in God's existence is the first step, but trust is the next step, and it is not an easy one. And I would add, within the word trust, mitzvah observance exists. Because you trust Hashem that even though you slept less because you went to shul, and even though you worked less because you didn't work on Shabbos, and even though you related to your family less because you went out to learn for an hour in the evening, and even though a lot of things, it ends up good for you. Part of trust is, you told me to do this, so I'm doing it, even though I really rather hang out with my kids. I work all day. Right? It's okay, your kids will still like you. They might even come to your class someday. Right? So, you know, the trust is the extension, behavior in God is the extension of belief in God. And the decision to do the right thing is what's in your hands. And how it carries itself out is in the Ribbono Shalom's hands. And believing in that is also part of the trust. Right? So we spoke about this recently. Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz writes, I think it's Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz who writes this, that there's a very famous story that there's a very famous story in the Talmud. It's the Talmud, I think, in Sota, says that when the Jewish people were at the edge of the sea, before the sea split, that all of the tribes were like mocking one another, saying, "You jump first. I don't want to jump. You jump first." Because Hashem was saying, "Believe that it's going to split. Just keep walking." So we all, many I'm sure, know the name. I spoke about it just this past Shabbos. That Nachshon ben Aminadav, the head of the tribe of Yehuda, he said, he jumped in first. While they were all grappling over who's going to believe in Hashem, he showed faith in Hashem and he grappled first. So I think it's Rechaim Shmulevitz who says, what's going on here? These are the children of Avraham and Yitzchak. We believe that if Avraham and Yitzchak did something, then it becomes part of the genetics of a Jewish person, their spiritual genes, So if Yitzchak was willing to put out his neck to Avraham's knife, and Avraham was willing to take his knife to Yitzchak's neck, these are our people who will sacrifice for Hashem. They're willing to die. They're willing to die for God. So how could all the tribes be saying to one another, you go first? These are the children of Avraham and Yitzchak. To which he answers something so amazing, which is great. But you know what Avraham and Yitzchak were willing to do? They were willing to die on behalf of God. That's not what was being asked of the tribes when they were saying, walk into the sea. What was being asked of the tribes when they walked into the sea is, believe it's going to be okay. And you're not going to die. You won't have the benefit of saying, of checking out at that moment. Believe it's going to be okay. Go in there, and even though it's a raging sea, it's going to be okay. That's pretty hard. That was the greatness of Nachshon and his merit, the sea split. And you know the truth is that everybody else lost out. Because anybody could walk into the sea once it split. I once knew somebody who had a tremendous test about carrying out God's will as it related to Shabbos. Doesn't matter what the test was. Tremendous test. He had an opportunity that involved Shabbos desecration. And he knew that he shouldn't do it. The thing was that the opportunity was soon going to end. So he reasoned, I'll begin to not make that violation anymore in a couple of months when this opportunity ends. And I told him, I said, you know that when the opportunity ends, so does the opportunity to succeed. So it's up to you. In other words, if you let the opportunity to win pass you by, then sure you have the opportunity to do what's easier. But now you have the opportunity to win. And then when that last opportunity passes by, so yes, now you've moved on to that next stage. But it was only after consecutive losses. In the particular person, in the particular test, in the particular details of their life. Fine, it's not transferable to any one of our lives, but we all have that thing, whatever that thing is, and that's where trust really comes in. Trust comes in to, I'm going to live, you know, like we've expressed here many times in the shul. The truth is that it's easier to die al-Kiddush Hashem than to live al-Kiddush Hashem. Because to live al-Kiddush Hashem means to wake up in the morning and never speak Lashon Hara all day. Right? To live al-Kiddush Hashem means to wake up in the morning and never... Whatever. You finished the sentence. You can have all the examples you want. Lashon Hara obviously resonated well enough. So that's tough stuff. That's tough stuff. That's tough stuff. But that's... I don't know if I answered all the questions. I hope I spoke to some of what you asked. Yeah. I think you had a question also.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I had a little discussion with God today after I listened to the news. And I was ranting and raving in my house alone and talking to God. So I thought about God today.
The news meaning the Iran deal?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't understand if we're supposed to survive, and I believe that we will survive in whatever form or remnant of the Jewish people. And I believe in God, but it's hard to believe when you see the same things happening over and over and over and over to the Jewish people. Not only to the Jewish people. I mean, this is a world that looks to me like it's coming to an end. It really does. And so when I talk to someone who is a Christian, who is my stockbroker, we have the best discussions about religion. We don't talk about stocks anymore because she quotes the Bible to me. In Ezekiel, it says that this is going to happen, and it's happening. And I'm listening to her thinking, I mean, she's a Christian, and she reads the Bible, and she believes literally in all of those things, and maybe that's the truth, and maybe God did say. And if we read the Torah and we see, like you said, these things keep happening over and over and over, but we're still here. And that, but when you have nuclear war, is anybody going to be here?
She should be wounded.
No, I'm serious. To me, that's a very major And I don't get it. I don't understand it. I can't wrap my head around that concept.
So let's there's a passage here in 44 that I want to quote that I think deals with your question. The second paragraph, it says, this is the kind of surrender that we call serenity. And it is a surrender that can only come after much struggle, intellectual and emotional, exertion, thinking, study, rigorous intellectual discipline, and prayer. And after all that, we become like a child, trusting in our Father who is God. And all of this is a result of emuna and bitachon, belief and trust. It is a solid anchor in a turbulent universe. And there's more. True belief can help us see a pattern and purpose in our lives. We really begin to sense that God is truly in control. Sometimes we see it only in retrospect, after things have happened to us. You may remember that scene in Exodus 33. That's what I was alluding to before. It's the most clear, yet esoteric interaction between man and God, where Moshe is saying to Hashem, show me your ways, show me your path. And God says, you go into behind the rock, and this is what's going to happen. Reread that. It's in Parshas Kisisa, and you won't know what it means, okay? But you know something's happening here, right? So you may remember that the scene in Exodus 33 where Moshe asks Hashem to show him his ways so that he, a human being, will understand how God directs the universe. It's an amazing moment. God replies by ordering Moshe to get down into the cleft of the rock, and as God passes by, Moshe will be granted the opportunity to see God. Moshe gets down. God passes by. What does Moshe see? The Torah tells us that Moshe only sees the back of God. That is, he could only see God after God had passed by, meaning that God's work is often so hidden that we understand it only in retrospect, long after it has taken place. So, couple that with this. Well, I don't want to, the verb couple is bad because I'm going to tell you three things. So, whatever, group that with this, okay? Group that with the Vilna Gaon wrote 250 years ago that the five books of the Chumash foretell all of history. The first book of Bereshis is about the first 2,000 years. Then the book of Shemos is about the next millennium, the 3,000s. Or the third millennium, the book of Vayikra is about the fourth. The book of Bamidbar is about the fifth, and the book of Devarim is about the sixth millennium, which is the millennium in which we live. And there he says that if you follow world history, you see world history play out as the Chumash describes that particular history. So, who doesn't see that now in 2015? That near the end of the book, there's this massive destruction of the Jewish people in chapter 28, which describes many things that, like, I once heard many years ago from a Rabbi Binny Friedman who lives in Yerushalayim, but he didn't live in Yerushalayim then, I don't think. He says that one of the curses is the land will be iron and the sky will be copper. What in the world does that mean? Until you go to Auschwitz, where the land is filled with iron deposits because of the bones of our grandparents, and the roofs of all of the gas chambers are filled with green residue because of the copper base of Zyklon B. Okay? And women, it says, will have to give their children to the non-Jews. And so on and so forth. Okay? And what's that immediately followed by? The Jewish people will return to the land of Israel. And what's that immediately followed by? Mass tshuva. The Jews will rediscover God. Okay, welcome to 2015. Right? So fascinating.
So we're close to the end, though.
Yeah, we are close to the end. That's part of our belief system. Yes, we're close to the end. So that's welcome to 2015. So now,
what's close to me? How many?
Mashiach comes.
I understand it, but how many is close? Is like, to me, close is like tomorrow, not another 1,000 years.
No comment. You know, I don't know. If I had the answer,
our time or in Hashem's time, it's two different time zones.
Okay, here's the third Here's the third piece. Okay, that I said I would say three things. Before my wife's other grandfather passed away, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, he was my Rosh Hashiva in Baltimore, one of the great Gedolei Torah of our generations, for whom this young man is named. And before he passed away, I once asked him in a private conversation, the way I see things going, keep this in mind, this was 1999 probably, things have gotten much weirder since then. Okay, so in 1999 I said to him, everywhere the Jews have been, they've eventually left. Why in the world should anybody believe that we're going to be here? What's the point of investing in this? And I'll tell you something more frightening. Or even the point of investing in Israel. Who says that this current reality of the Jewish people will be in the land of Israel is the first flowering of the redemption? Who says? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Right? So I said to him, in my younger 20s, how do you know? Why should we believe that we're not just going to move on to the next exile? So he said to me, we have a Kabbalah. I have to tell you something. The man was hyper logical, totally not into Hasidic mises. Okay? In fact, he grew up in a renowned Hasidic family. He was a grandson of the Slonim Rebbe. Okay? Renowned Hasidic family. He was non-Hasidic to the max. He wasn't the type to believe in mises, in somebody said, some kind of prophecy or something like that. And his response to me was, we have a Kabbalah, which means we've received from many of the Gedolei Hador, the great people of generation, including Reb Chaim Ozer, who was a great Lithuanian Chacham, not a Hasidic master. He said that the New World is the final stop. New World is the final stop. That's given. In other words, we believe that sometimes there's Ruach HaKodesh, that the great people of generation, out of their Torah scholarship, also become knowledgeable of things beyond just the... They can see what's said in the white space in the Torah also, not just in the black letters. Okay? So he says, the new world is going to be the last stop. You asked how long? I have no idea how long, but I heard this story from the person who heard it himself, Rabbi Aaron Feldman. This is now piece number 4 in answering your question. Rabbi Aaron Feldman was a young married person. He's now the Rosh Yeshiva in Baltimore. He's the brother of this man. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, he's the Rosh Hashiva in our yeshiva in Baltimore. And when he was a young man in 1967, I don't know if you ever heard this story, he was a young married person with a young family living in Eretz Yisrael in Bnei Brak. And many Americans who lived in Israel were leaving Israel for the safe haven of going home to America because they felt that war was imminent. He went and asked one of the greatest rabbis of the generation, Rav Shach, if he should go to America with his wife and young kids or he should stay in Israel. And Rav Shach told him he should go to America. It didn't sit well with him. So he went to the Stipler Gaon, Rav Yaakov Kanayevsky. And he asked the Stipler, should I go back to America? And the Stipler said to him, in late May of 1967, the Stipler said to him, stay here. There's going to be a war that will last less than a week. And we will win a very great victory.
Six-day war.
Correct. Okay. It's a matter of days, we'll win a very great victory. Stay here. To which Rav Aaron Feldman said to him, but even if we win, who's to say that we won't be among the Chevle Mashiach? Chevle Mashiach is a term that means the ones that are destroyed in the bringing of Mashiach. To which the Stipler said to him, the Chevle Mashiach already happened. So he said, when? He said, in the war, in the Second World War. He says, then where's Mashiach? So he says, it can take 70 years.
What year?
Here we are.
I don't know what year you can be. You can choose the latest date you want. Okay? You choose the latest date you want.
From the end of World War II.
That's my point. Yeah, I don't care. You choose the date. You can come up with an eighth, the farthest you can extend it to say that was still part of that.
I don't think we should lose any sleep over it, though.
No, we shouldn't.
Okay.
We shouldn't. And I don't play the prophet games.
But when did we do it?
In 45.
7 years ago.
Okay. So.
But we're still here, so.
Yeah. So, but I agree that I'm not here to share with you prophecy. And I don't know what it means. And I've heard before numbers and they don't mean that. You know, there's 12 months of the year. Yeah, sure. There's actually 13, the second Adar. Okay. There's 12 tribes. Yeah, sure. There's really 13. You know, Ephraim, Menashe, and Levi. You know, so I don't know. I'm sure. Here's the point though, getting back, that the getting back is that the Torah tells us that Moshe only sees the back of God. That is, he could only see God after God had passed by, meaning that God's work is often so hidden that we understand it. We understand it only in retrospect, long after it has taken place. Here's what I do know. There was a Haman, and we won. Mm-hmm. By the way, I also know that we couldn't sit when there was a Haman and say, Hashem will provide. She had to go in and ask, and we had to take up arms, and fine. Good.
But Purim took like 100 years.
Why do you say it took 100 years? No, it didn't
take 100 years. The story of Purim was like 100 years, wasn't it?
No. It's several years, but not the episode of this thing is a matter of short time. You know?
Wasn't the
feast? But it is several years from the feast until the events, but not 100. Oh. You know, more like...
I thought it was 9.
Something like that, yeah. Nine. A decade. Something uh-huh. like that, yeah. But the point is that there was a Haman, and we won, and we had to have the interplay that we spoke about last week of bitachon, trust, and hishtadlus, and effort. So I'm not sitting here saying we shouldn't examine the accord, and Netanyahu is the captain of hishtadlus. His job is to make the effort. If you ask me if I'm losing sleep over it, the answer is no. My wife was mad at me. How come you're not getting all angry about it? I said, first of all, I got 50 emails today about everybody else getting angry about it. They're taking care of it. You know, I don't have to issue a statement. I'm good. Right? But back to the serenity piece is, if we look at history, there was a Haman and we defeated him. Even though there was tremendous casualty, there was a Hitler, and now there's everything we have. That's up to you if you want to go there. That's fine. It's not my place. But my point is, we can see
even
that,
the guy I'm calling.
Well, that's in every generation.
We're not okay. I was just joking when I said you should go there. We're not going there all the way. Not until the tape is off, at least. But the point is,
yes.
The point is that can the master of the universe be trusted? That he's got a plan.
Yes.
I believe the master of the universe can be trusted. That he has a plan. And I think we got some good guys in good positions to see to that plan. And I also think that every single moment the Jewish people ever have involves they fasted for 3 days and they called out to God in prayer. Remember, that's what happened in Purim. The Purim story is not. They took up arms and they, you know, if you think the whole thing is your own efforts, you don't fast, you eat. So that you're strong, so you can defeat your enemy. Right? So the Klal Yisrael has that responsibility to have a God-centered response to man-centered troubles and to make efforts. Okay, with this, we will close tonight's discussion.
I'm trying to tell you something.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.